I know that there was, from some of the other parts of your research, that you're looking also at the way in which U.S. propaganda is targeting women in the southern cone of South America at the time. So I wonder if you could speak to us a little bit about that and what the motivations are of sort of speaking directly to the women listeners in South America and the role that the U.S. played in these propaganda efforts.
Well, what happened is that, and there's been a lot of really interesting work that's been done recently on radio propaganda during World War II in Latin America. There seems little question that actually the, particularly the Germans, were doing a better job inserting pro-German propaganda in Latin America than the United States was. The U.S. was a little bit late in the game. But they do kind of get into it towards the end of the war. You had the creation of the Office of Inter-American Affairs, which was headed up at the time by Nelson Rockefeller. And one of the, this was essentially an agency of the Good Neighbor Policy. Mm-hmm. The goal here was to create an agency whose main charge was to shore up relations between the United States and Latin America and to undercut what was seen as Nazi, Axis, pro-Axis, fascist influence in the region. The Organization of Inter-American Affairs had its radio division, and the job of the radio division was to both monitor the content of radio broadcasts in Latin America and also to produce its own propaganda materials that it would have placed on commercial radio stations throughout Latin America, usually without identifying those programs as such. They were not identified as programs that were made under the auspices of the U.S. government. And particularly towards the very end of the war, late 1944 and into 1945, there was a turn towards programming that was specifically the production of OIAA programming specifically targeting Latin American women. And so there were a number of programs that were created, programs that were written and recorded in Spanish and placed on radio stations throughout Latin America that were meant to present the United States in a favorable light. They were meant to showcase the advancements and achievements of women in the United States, in addition to showcasing, if you will, the sufferings and hardships of the civilian population in the United States during the war, and how American women, North American women, were getting by with shortages and rationing and those sorts of things.
And so what were these shows like? How were they formatted? What were the content of these shows?
Well, there were some of the shows that I found the most interesting is were shows that some of them were written as so-called script services. So which meant that the script or the general script was generated in the United States and then sent down to radio stations or to their, the OIAA also had its local committees, mostly made up of expatriate U.S. citizens in various Latin American countries, who would then have those scripts recorded, most importantly using the local accent and the local dialogue as a way to present these stations, as these programs, as locally generated, even when they were not. So there were those kinds of programs that went on that were, you know, oftentimes the general scenario that was used were kind of travel programs, stories of, say, Ecuadorian girls who traveled to the United States during wartime and would tell about what they saw and what they experienced during the war. This was a fairly common format. Towards the end of the war, you had the creation of more ambitious undertakings, basically following the kind of radio soap opera format, programs that were generally recorded in their entirety in the United States, mostly in New York, and sent down for placement on radio stations in Latin America. One of the programs that I was able to get an entire script for was a program called Diálogos Femeninos, Women's Feminine Dialogues, which was the basic the basic structure of the story was a woman, were two women, one named Angelica, and Angelica was an Uruguayan woman who was a little older and had been living in New York for quite some time, and so sort of knew her way around, was more bilingual, if you will, both in a linguistic and in a cultural sense. And her new roommate, Olga, who was a young, beautiful Venezuelan woman who was a recent arrival in New York. And it was about the kind of experiences and adventures of these two young Latin American women in New York City, who both, of course, end up falling in love with American GIs and all of these kinds of things. But it was really, you know, as I said, meant to introduce the Latin American female listening audience to life in the United States, and particularly life for women in the United States. And the notion that was often thrown out is that, you know, the idea that women were freer, more liberated, less constrained in the United States than they were in Latin America. But the authors of the script also take great pains to underscore the honor and morality of these young women, that even though they have more freedom to move about, they are still honorable and moral young women who are still controlling themselves and their sexuality despite this you know, universe that is New York City, the Gran Manzana, right, the Big Apple.
Have you been able to gain any sense of how these propaganda efforts were received in Uruguay?
And these programs were aired all over Latin America, although they tended to find the most favorable audience in places where the accents matched. This was always a problem that U.S. propagandists had in creating these programs, because if they used, say, Mexican actresses to record the programs, people would complain in Chile or Argentina that they didn't like the way the people sounded. And if they used Argentine actresses, they got the same kind of complaints in Mexico. So there were always these kinds of issues with the programs. But it seems as though the programs were relatively well received, but as I said, in a very uneven way, depending on the region and the success of placement. Because, you know, they did provide this kind of travelogue view, and programs like Diálogos Femeninos threw in enough of the kind of romantic aspects of things, I think, to potentially keep listeners interested and to lull them into a sense. Diálogos Femeninos was very careful to keep its propaganda aspects, to be very to use a very kind of light hand in its propagandizing. If you had, sometimes you had characters, particularly the American characters, the U.S. characters would have outbursts about the need to defend freedom and what the war was about and these sorts of things, these fairly strong statements about the war, and they would always then follow by apologizing for their outbursts. So there was this real attempt to be very soft in the way the messages were being presented to the audience.
And have you been able to listen to any of these tracks?
No, there are no recordings, unfortunately, of any of these things. What is available in the National Archives, the U.S. National Archives, are the scripts in their entirety for this program and a couple of others. So we have the scripts, which in terms of radio history is better than what we usually have, but unfortunately, recordings we do not have.
And with Radio Femenina, any tracks left behind there or?
Nothing. And there's mostly, unfortunately, what we have are the radio magazines themselves and the occasional, in this case, the archives of Paulina Luisi do contain some of her radio speeches. Radio speeches that she gave on Radio Femenina and on other stations as well. But otherwise, unfortunately, we're dealing with a pretty ephemeral media, and for which gaining access to sources is a little bit tricky.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious also about just the mere notion of having women very present on the radio at the time. It must have been relatively new in the 1930s to have women so prominent in the mainstream media. So I'm curious if there was any sort of feedback about that, a response, or...
It's a subject that's of great interest to me, the question of women's voices on the radio. It was most certainly a new thing, and one that was still considered fairly shocking for people to hear women speaking on the radio. In terms of the controversy over women's speaking on the radio, there's more to be found actually in the documents on Argentina than there is in Uruguay. Mm-hmm. In the United States, just to put it in context, what U.S. radio historians have seen is that in the late 1920s, so radio is still a new medium, but it's starting to get on its feet, there was a fairly strong backlash against women's speaking voices on the airwaves. And the justification in that case was really technological. The argument was made that the relatively primitive radio technology of the time distorted upper register sounds. So flutes and piccolos sounded bad, and women's voices sounded bad. And so the argument for keeping women off the airwaves was not that it was improper, even though that was how many people felt. The reason that was given was that women's voices sounded bad on the radio. Now, in Latin America, by the time radio gets going, even in more affluent parts of the region like Argentina and Uruguay, a lot of those technological obstacles have been overcome. Those earlier kinds of problems of upper register sound have been fixed. So the hostility towards women speaking on the air and the way women spoke on the radio comes around in other kinds of ways. And you see it quite clearly in the radio press in Buenos Aires in the 1930s, much more clearly than it seems to appear in Uruguay, for reasons that are not entirely clear to me. But in Argentina in the early to mid-1930s, there's this growing campaign against women speakers on the airwaves. And the criticism is not based on technological reasons, but really about the way that women spoke. Women were criticized for using too many adjectives, for speaking in very flowery, irrational kinds of ways. And so there was this clamor against women's speech on the airwaves. And so, you know, and this becomes kind of reaches its high point in the mid-1930s, and you do start to see a growing backlash against women's speech on the radio.
Was there any other experiments with Radio Feminina or versions of Radio Feminina in other countries in Latin America?
There was. The one case that I know of was there was an attempt in 1936. A pre-existing radio station in Buenos Aires called Radio Cultura, which announced with all kinds of fanfare in 1936 that it was going to go to an all-women's format, clearly following in the footsteps of Radio Feminina in Montevideo across the river. But in the case, in the Argentine case, that experiment didn't really work. The all-women's format lasted for less than a year on Radio Cultura, at which point the station went back to more traditional kinds of format. So there's a number of kinds of ways to explain that. I mean, I think it just, you know, sort of why it didn't work. I mean, I think there was a different kind of gender environment in Buenos Aires at the time. There were and most importantly, I think there was a lot more money involved. The Buenos Aires radio market was a big market. It generated a lot of revenue, and trying to gain sufficient advertising revenue for this kind of niche radio station just was really unsuccessful, and the station couldn't make it work from a financial standpoint, which is interesting given what was happening with Radio Feminina, which was a fairly successful venture for at least for a couple of years across the river in Montevideo.
Mm-hmm. I'm also curious because you mentioned that the original sponsors of Radio Feminina was a dairy company. And so I know that that's fairly typical of that region. Are the meat companies and the dairy companies very involved in radio programming at the time, or what's the sort of corporate background to the evolution of broadcasting?
Well, certainly companies like that were very involved, and you know, the usual things that you see in the United States as well, the soap companies and cleaning products and all of those kinds of household goods that were aimed primarily at female consumers, especially at middle-class housewives, were important sponsors for these sorts of things. The meat companies were important. And you know, these were the kind of major sponsors that you saw. You also see occasional automobile companies and their, you know, kind of bigger ticket consumer items who were sponsoring certain programs. But most of that was you were going to be more likely to see during the primetime evening hours at a time when men were more likely to be listening rather than women.
And so when we left off with Radio Feminina, you mentioned that they had gotten their license back in March 1945.
Right.
And can you tell us what happens after?
What happens, and again, this is another area where it's really quite fuzzy. Trying to do the history of Radio Feminina has been a challenge. It's very interesting because I speak to a lot of Uruguayans and they say, oh, well, if there was a station like that, it was only on the air for a few years because that was just not an important thing. And when I tell them that the station was on the air for something around 35 years, they're shocked. But what happened is that the station, but clearly Radio Feminina never recovered the prominence that it had in the later 1930s. The station remained on the air. There is evidence of its license being renewed up until the early 1970s. I have a radio survey from 1955, which indicates that Radio Feminina had a small audience, but still a substantial one. It was managing to compete with a lot of other stations. By that point, the radio panorama in Montevideo in particular was that one station, which I mentioned previously, Radio Carve, dominated the listenership, the radio landscape in Uruguay to a tremendous degree. So Radio Carve had the majority of the audience, and a fairly large number of stations fought over the crumbs of what was left of the listenership. What I have been told by listeners is that Radio Feminina in the 1950s carved out a niche for itself as the premier jazz station in the city, that it maintained its name as Radio Feminina. It continued to have all women announcers, but it became an important jazz station. And as I was told by one gentleman who I interviewed, who would have been a young man in the 50s, he said, all of the young people listened to Radio Feminina. They had the best jazz library in the city. And the radio survey from 1955 seems to bear that out. Radio Feminina had a substantial male listening audience in addition to a female audience. Its listenership was generally younger and more working class than many other stations. So I'm still trying to figure out what happened at the end for Radio Feminina. It appears the station went off the air in the early 1970s, which would have been the run-up to the military coup in Uruguay in 1972, and was a time of increasing authoritarianism in the country. I've seen material that suggests that the station was actually shut down again for political reasons, which is kind of interesting that you had the station. If this were true, it would be a great story that the station was shut down in the 1940s because of allegations of pro-Nazi sympathies and was shut down in the early 1970s because of allegations of pro-communist sympathies. But it's a little bit premature. I'm still trying to figure out what exactly happened there. But the station definitely went off the air in the early 1970s.
So thank you very much, Dr. Eric.
You're very welcome.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Christine Eric, Associate Professor of History from the University of Louisville, who's taken time to talk with us about women in radio in the Rio de la Plata of the 1930s and 1940s.